Today's episode is brought to you by Slate House Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
Hey everybody, I'm Jeremy. This is Slate House Publishing presents Lit Bits, and this is our second episode into looking at vampires, and specifically Bram Stoker's Dracula. Dracula. With me, as always, is Trevor and Curtis. Say hello, guys.
Hello, guys.
Thank you.
What's up?
Yeah, Trevor just doesn't get the airplane jokes. it's like, surely you must be joking. I'm not joking, and don't call me
I'm
Shirley.
I'm not joking.
last time we talked about vampires just kind of around the world. We talked about vampire myths and where vampires come from. And today we have a look into Bram Stoker's life. And one of the things I think is really interesting, because we talked about this kind of, we alluded to this a little bit in the Karen Huff episode about how people tend to associate the writer and their life in their fictional works. And of all the things that Bram Stoker wrote, the consensus is that the Dracula is probably his most autobiographical book out there. So today we're going to talk a little bit about Bram Stoker and the man who created the novel Dracula. But I think first we were going to mention, because by the time this episode airs, we would have, it's been a few weeks, but at the recording of this episode, we just learned that Anne Rice had passed away.
Yeah. Very sadly.
And, she was older than I thought she was. I mean, I think she was what, about 80?
Yeah, I believe she was 80 years old.
So I mean, that is sad. It's really, because they were there. She's kind of had a resurgence. Like, I think it's AMC or somebody is doing a new like Interview with the Vampire
series.
They're
bringing a whole.
They're doing
series
the whole books,
life.
Right? Like all the, not just the first novel.
I think the intention was to do all of, because all of those books are in kind of a shared.
They're a shared
sequence,
universe,
right?
Yeah. So we're actually, what's kind of interesting about this is that we're going to talk about a little about Anne Rice and kind of what she did for the vampire as we talk about in our fourth episode,
where
we're going. That's kind of how we're going to end the series, I think, is kind of how vampires have evolved.
Yeah. But I think, you know, as we have this conversation, because we originally started wanting to talk about Bram Stoker, because Stoker was to you kind of the person who represented the strongest paradigm shift in all of vampire fiction. And it's really difficult to get away from what Stoker was doing with vampires. You know, as we were talking about Anne Rice's influence over vampires and vampiric fiction, I think there's not been a book since the 1970s that doesn't owe at least something to Anne Rice's vampires.
Sure.
I mean a vampire fiction or urban fantasy.
And that's something we'll delve into a little more in depth at that later episode.
Yeah.
I mean, going back to my thesis, I feel like not just vampire fiction, but horror fiction in general. I mean, it Stoker's is one of the most important works to give legitimacy to that genre in the realm of literature, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
So today we're going to talk a little bit about his life, and we're working off of three sources. And like always with all of our books and everything that we talk about, I'm going to post the sources on our website. But for a brief chronological timeline, we're going to talk about, we're going to use the University of Missouri's website that adapted from the Norton Critical Dracula edition by Auerbach and Skull. They have a chronological timeline for Stoker's life. We're going to rely on Barbara Bedford's Bram Stoker and the Man Who Is Dracula.
Belford,
what did I say?
Bedford?
Yeah.
Well, you know.
Wrong.
Bedford, Belford. I mean, I don't
know. You got bats in your belfry?
I have bats in my belfry. I have bats in my Belford. We can cut all this, by the way. This is and our producer's shaking his head like, no, this is staying in.
This is another tangential moment here.
Uh-oh.
Trevor said tangential.
There's that word again.
Listen to that mistake, everybody. He said tangential.
Just completely taking it out of the contest.
Who in their right mind would say such a wrong word like that? And finally, we have Paul Murray from The Shadow of Dracula, Life of Bram Stoker. Again, I'll put these sources on our website. So if you want to check them out, what we're giving you today is by no means a complete history of Bram Stoker's life. We are touching on, we couldn't do that. I mean, this episode's going to be long enough.
That granular, I mean, I would have to read these books.
I would read Belford's book. I mean, hers is considered the quintessential story of Bram Stoker. So I would read her book. What we're doing is we're going to touch on his life, and we're going to talk about a little bit about just the aspects of his life that helped him shape and create what we know as the novel of Dracula today.
Sure.
So Abraham Stoker was born in Dublin in 1847. He was born to an interestingly prominent family, and that his family name on both sides, like his mom and his dad, could be linked back 500 years to some of the most famous names in Ireland. But his dad was never really that rich. His dad was decidedly middle class. His dad actually, in the time of his death in the 1870s, had quite a bit of debt that Stoker had to help kind of like line out and kind of fix. So Stoker, I feel like I'm just talking and you guys are quiet. Is there like, do you guys have anything you want to jump in and say on this or?
No,
like,
I'm learning.
You're learning.
Yeah, I'm just listening to you.
This is
words.
News to me too. So.
Okay. Well, so Stoker was one of seven children. His oldest brother, I love this name, Thornley. Honey, if you're listening,
I like that too.
I want to name our first child Thornley.
Thornley.
Thornley Billingsley.
Ooh.
Because why the hell? I mean, I just want him to go to school. I mean,
that kid's gonna get picked on so bad, though.
He will stand.
You know
up
what?
For
here's
better,
what
for
you
worse.
Do. You name him Thornley, but then you also ensure that he's just carrying around like Wolverine claws all the time.
There you go.
And he just pokes people that make fun of him.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna as a baby, I'm gonna build a special pouch to where I carry him on the side of me, so that I can be like, I have a thorn on my side. I can make my own child my own pun.
Oh no!
That's
what is the
for,
purpose
right?
of having children if not to name them puns?
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I learned that from Adam's Family Values when they named the baby.
Imperative.
I named that. I mean, Adam's Family Values when he named the baby Pubert. I mean.
Oh man. Of the bad names for children, it's like Pubert Renesmee. I still can't get over Twilight's Renesmee. What a stupid name.
Renesmee.
Okay.
It's
a terrible name.
Stoker's older brother was named Thornley. And what's interesting is that in their lifetime, in their mother's lifetime, of the seven children, you would think Bram Stoker would be the most successful, but he wasn't. His brother Thornley was the most successful.
Okay, but we don't remember Thornley Stoker in the 20s.
Like, you will after this episode is done.
I do now.
You're going to know. You are going to know Thornley
that
Stoker.
That might be one of the coolest names I've ever heard.
Thornley Stoker.
I mean,
stars
Stoker
in.
Stoker alone is a cool last name.
It is.
Yeah.
I want to, I think I'm going to legally change my name to Stoker. Yeah. What's his great nephew name?
De Craye. Is it that
De Craye Stoker. He's like alive now. He's an author now.
How do you spell that? De Craye.
D-A-C-R-E. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's a kind of constituted the vampire myth and like wrote a sequel to Dracula and all those.
I was thinking apostrophe C-R-A-Y. De Craye. Like a street in New Orleans or something.
Well,
I mean,
I could
be mispronouncing it.
The reason I say Thornley was the most successful is he becomes a doctor. He has a really high position in government. He actually becomes knighted by Queen Victoria at one point, but I'll get into that in a little bit.
Thornley did?
Thornley got knighted. We have Sir Thornley. It's not just Thornley Stoker. It's Sir Thornley Stoker.
Whoa.
STS, man. STS. Sir Thornley Stoker.
Yes.
God. So for Bram himself, for the young boy, his father was also named Abraham. So that's probably why he went by Bram, to kind of distinguish himself a little bit. But he was really, really sickly as a child. And so he spent a lot of time by the sea. He spent a lot of time reading. He spent a lot of time learning about like sea myths. And these kinds of things play very heavily into his future fiction. They never discuss exactly what he was sick with. They say he was near to the point of death a few times, but he was just a really frail child, and it took his mother and the nurse they hired to help take care of him. The kids
did they
all
know what he was sick with. Like,
I think they knew what he was sick with, but I don't think they ever revealed what he was sick with.
Okay.
So I think they kind of hid that, and like Stoker himself would never talk about it.
The illness reveal party that just never coalesced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of balloon would that be? Like,
I like, sound so puke sad. Green.
Puke green.
Yeah, boom. You.
It's typhoid.
Yeah.
I can't even get through the joke. It just bursts.
What cupcakes do you bring to a typhoid reveal like party?
Oh
like,
my god.
You've got the pox, Charlie.
See, the sprinkles look like the pox.
Oh my god.
I hate red velvet cake, mommy.
The 19th century just became way more interesting.
The 19th century is cool. And
it's cool. They got disease.
Yeah. It's cool. They have disease. It's like if you ever loved like old cool gothic, like if you were ever a goth in high school, you would have loved Victorian England. Like it was totally your jam, know. Man. So what's it's assumed that I forgot where I was going to go with that. Like I totally got lost. And I feel
what,
like this,
what was it assumed that he had?
There were a number, I don't know, there were a number of things. It was something bloodborne or it was something,
some kind of demon.
It wasn't a demon. I think they knew that it was not a demon.
Okay. All right.
I think they were middle-class Irish Catholics. I mean, the only demons they had were
alcoholism.
We just lost the Irish
Let's
listeners.
Be real though. The Irish are going to stick around. They know what it's about.
Yeah.
They get it.
They definitely get it.
It could have been a number of things. It could have been a heart condition. It could have been something respiratory. It was something serious that left him very, very sick at some point. Mm. But it was not something that was debilitating for the rest of his life. And I'm going to get into that in a few minutes.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing how you said he's a sickly child and he came close to death like several times, right?
Right.
And then he just gets over it.
He gets better.
Well,
yeah, that's the
that
weird thing.
That kind of was the way that a lot of 19th century medicine went. I mean, if you consider medicine even into the 20th century, even in Europe, it was not that great, right?
Yeah. There were antibiotics, right?
No, because I get into that. Actually, in part of the timeline, we see where Stoker, I kind of compare where Stoker was alive, like his life, what kind of big things were going on around that time. So, for instance, the year of his birth, James Malcolm Rymer first serialized his penny dreadful Vammy the Vampire. Am I saying that right, Trevor?
I've never heard of it. Vammy the Vampire?
Vammy
sure.
the Vampire. So,
that makes sense.
And the year that Stoker entered college in Trinity College, Dublin, the American Civil War was going on.
Right,
so,
1863.
In 1863. Yeah. Stoker was 16 years old. He was not a great student. He was like on his entry rank into the like his class, his freshman class, he was like 41 out of 50. So he was a very mediocre student.
Hmm.
Yeah, you're humming that.
He's
like,
in the bottom 20%.
It's just a little too relatable for me. That's why I'm reeling over here.
But look at what he aspired to. So, you know, I mean, just because you're in the bottom 20%, you can still aim for the stars.
Yeah, that don't matter.
We need that NBC, the more you know, that ding, 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 ding.
You think you can only make it.
You just broke a copyright.
I did just break a copyright.
We're being sued by the Peacock now.
Okay. Well, yeah. There you go, guys.
They're coming after
It was nice knowing you. Slay House is now out of business, so all right.
NBC needs every cent they can get.
I just heard the other day that those two things are not affiliated.
Really?
The Peacock Network?
Really?
Like, maybe I'm wrong, but I heard somebody say that, yeah, NBC and Peacock are not.
I mean, their streaming service is called Peacock, and it airs all the NBC and NBC yeah. Universal stations. So.
Yeah, maybe I'm wrong. I thought it was,
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was kind of their unofficial mascot.
Peacock. I need to check that out.
Stoker, I'm going to give you some perspective here. Stoker was decidedly middle class, but so were the children of lawyers and bankers and businessmen and accountants. His dad was he was like mid-level public service. You know, he's kind of a grunt of a bureaucracy.
But that would also kind of make sense, right? Because if we're talking about 19th century Europe, I mean, even through industrialization, you're still going to have the upper class, which is mostly like former nobility, right?
Right.
Because the middle class only really exists because of like rich tradesmen, right? Or traders, you know, like merchants through previous centuries who kind of built this familial wealth.
Right. Yeah. And it only appeared after the effects. Actually, this is kind of interesting because the same time you were talking about how medicine wasn't that evolved, but medicine was more evolved than it had been in previous centuries because up until like the bubonic plague, which actually stretched out for a number of centuries across Europe, we think it's like one specific time period, but actually the plague kind of came in waves over several hundred years. Oh, okay. But they went from like they didn't believe anymore like humors and like bloodletting were like a thing. They were starting to learn about serious medicine because the plague had decimated the region, but the plague had also helped create the middle class.
Right. I mean, 19th century medicine was getting better and better and better. Right. At least in Europe, in the United States, medicine would languish behind until the 20th century. Really, it was only the early 20th century that we start to see American doctors get better. And around the time of the big influenza of 1920. I mean, that's
And it's kind of an illustration of this. We talk about
medicine caught up.
Exactly. Yeah, we talk about Stoker going into college in 1863. And his, you know, this is at the time of the American Civil War. People were still dying from like gunshot wounds to like not even important parts of the body. They were having their legs amputated. They were dying from infection from these gunshot wounds in their legs. So medicine still had a long way to go. What's interesting is that even though Stoker was not a strong academic, he still had a big presence there in college. So Stoker was part of the College Historical Society and the College Philosophical Society, and those were called the Hist and the Fist, I guess. Yeah, you can make of that what
All
you
right,
want.
Let's be real. A whole bunch of weird history nerds and philosophers were like, we're going to name ourselves this because I'm tired of getting sand kicked in my face by the Charles Atlas crowd, right? Yeah, the Hist and the Fist. They come in and they punch you.
But
rough group.
They punch you in the groin, because that's where the Hist comes from, right?
The Hist. The Hist. And the Fist.
The Hist.
That's what I name my feet. The Hist and the Fist. I'm a kicker. Like, now How I Met Your Mother's going to sue us. He was really big into these programs. And as sick as I said Stoker was as a child, he actually became a huge athlete. He became a very, very powerful athlete. And if you look at photos of him to this day, he's a very broad-shouldered, like strong-looking guy. He's a buff dude.
Damn.
Yeah.
Overcame the odds.
He pulled the
Teddy Roosevelt, huh?
Yeah. He did. He almost kind of looks like Teddy Roosevelt.
I like
in some
the
of
idea
picks.
That he had there's a Bram Stoker calendar out there, and it's just his muscle poses.
I like August because it's his bikini pick. You know, Stoker, he didn't publish a lot at this time, but he was always reading. He was always attending lectures. He was an officer in these historical societies. A lot of people think that what started, by the way, this rift between Stoker and Oscar Wilde was this the fact that he had kept Oscar Wilde out of one of these historical societies. And that couldn't be further from the truth. He didn't have anything to do with that. He was really big into like gymnastics, rugby. For you Americans out there who don't know what rugby is, it's football on steroids. So you think football's rough, like
I thought football was on steroids.
Football is on steroids, but rugby is like
rugby's like fewer pads, right?
Fewer pads, yeah. And
yeah.
More content.
But less like intentional head to head.
Oh yeah,
collision.
No.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're still missing a lot more teeth. He was into gymnastics. Like, this is a big dude. You can imagine him like on the trapeze and like the rings and stuff. I mean, that's huge.
I wonder what his floor show is all about. Like his floor program.
It involved the pole. No, it didn't. we can't make fun.
Damn,
we can't make
Stoker.
Fun. That's Mr. September. Can we make fun of our subject for the book?
He's dead. He doesn't care.
He's very dead.
He's very dead. He's been gone a long time.
I hope that's how I'm remembered. People just say weird shit about me.
I don't want to be, like, check it out. I don't want to be remembered like his dad. Listen, his dad was like 77 years old. He was a fine-looking, gentle, and good man, fond of his family, religious.
That's his obituary, right?
That's his obituary. Yeah. That's like the blandest, like, least entertaining, least, like, if you summed my life up like that.
He was just fine.
He was okay.
What a person he was.
He was the most average of us all.
The most average.
That's going, I'm putting that on your tombstone.
I'll take it, yeah. I'll take it, yeah.
Painfully average.
Painfully average.
Yeah.
I see that normal man, and he scares me.
he's too average.
If he was below average, I could understand. If he was above average, I could understand. But perfectly average? No way.
I just don't get it.
That's painful.
This is, you know, this is in a time when we have something like the Slender Man, which is just a tall white guy in a suit.
I still love the fact that an eighth grader's perfect idea of a horror monster is just a dude with a suit living in the woods. Yeah. That's it.
No. He's got tentacles that come out of his back. Well, you're missing that part.
He wears a suit and tie. Slender Man has a job and a gym membership. Yeah. Because he's slender.
He looks like the dude from that Christmas nightmare.
Nightmare Before Christmas.
He looks like a
wow, Curtis. He looks that's a good one.
The Christmas nightmare. You know, after Christmas.
Between you and Trevor Sands' genital. Yeah.
That was pretty rough.
That was. I keep passing, our listeners aren't going to get it, but like I keep passing off the tan's genital on Curtis, but it's really my tan's genital.
Yeah, you're going to have to just.
I like how you've even added an extra S to the word now. Tan's genital. Yeah. Tan's genital. You've made it into a verb.
I did.
Yeah.
Oh man.
After we leave this recording, I'm going to go tan's genital my.
You're going to tan your genitals.
Yeah.
Okay.
Moving on.
Can we move on?
Anyway.
So.
My face is red.
Who'd have thought this episode would have done that? This is. I'm. You know, Trevor did so good with the Star Wars episode. I'm really just trying to live up to that.
It's hard, right?
It is. No, we can't say anything like that now, talking about tangential and then, like, it's hard. And,
but we can talk about how this guy did the rings and the trapeze.
He did the rings and the trapeze. He did rugby. He won a lot of medals. He was not a good student, though. Most people, it took about 4 or 5 years to graduate. It took him about 6 or 7 years to graduate with his master's. So,
with his master's?
Yeah, he ended up earning an MA out of Trinity College.
In 6 or 7 years? Isn't that normal, though?
But I don't feel like they had a bachelor's at that program at that time. Like, I don't think it was just, I think they came out of the program with an MA. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
When you only live to be 40, you got to hurry up and get these things.
Yeah, you got to rush. Yeah.
Yeah. He entered civil service just like his dad in 1866 or 1867. They think maybe there was like a internship kind of appointment. So that's why there's a discrepancy on the years. That's the same year that the typewriter was patented. So, kind of cool. We now have typewriters. Kids, for those of you who don't know, typewriters came before computers and before, like, and laptops so and pads. And
I love the idea that a kid doesn't know what a typewriter is.
Exactly,
they're
right?
It's hard to come by now. Like, I don't know the last time I saw a typewriter.
I don't know. My wife bought one for my anniversary.
Oh, that's cool.
I don't have a ribbon for
it
yet.
Was it the one with the little, the letter, the ball, or the little hammers that swing and hit the
little hammers.
Yeah. Okay, those are cooler.
Oh, yeah.
They make such a good sound, too.
Yeah.
Let's all do it.
That's good.
Yeah.
Let's all make that sound.
That's the rest of the episode, folks. That's us just sitting around going.
It's such a tactile sensation, too.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Say, one of the guys asked me what a petty session, a clerk for petty sessions is.
What is it for sessions that are just really pedantic?
Yeah. So, my God, you're in here again?
Yeah.
actually, kind of, yeah. They
he
dealt with.
He stole my cereal this morning, miss.
It's really petty of you.
I mean, you make that joke, but they did. They dealt with like minor offenses.
Right. Yeah.
They audited accounts for the courts. I'm done. Blah, 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 blah. This episode brought to you today by Porky Pig. that's all, folks.
Oh, we're done?
No, but he, so he started working in this, and that was the first book he actually published too. It was a manual on how to, like streamline the clerk job, like description, and like make their jobs even more like mechanical and streamlined and more efficient.
A worthy read.
He's really the man.
He is. Yeah. He's a jack of all trades.
Yeah. Coming in, we need efficiency here.
When he's not trapezing.
Replace these by robots.
When he's not he's trapezing.
That's not a hobby. Rugby. That's like a big old commitment. You know, I think I'll take up trapezing for a bit. Like you're swinging and risking your life.
I gotta go
day.
Blow off some steam, and he's just doing the rings.
Yeah.
he swings down into like a rugby court and like beats up a bunch of guys.
Yes, it's all just in one like, big motion. And then he goes home like, all right,
he's now
Batman.
Now
it's time to write my manual on the petty clerk's job description.
Right.
Okay. The year he received his MA from the Trinity College, Charles Dickens died. That's
oh,
a
man.
Sad. I'm bringing it all together. Yeah,
poor Charles Dickens.
And a Goodbye. Moment of silence for Charles Dickens.
Really unappreciated.
We're not having that moment of silence. Mm. Our silence is us just making...
He's dead. He doesn't care.
We get a moment of silence for Charles Dickens. Yeah.
A year later, he assumed...
A Dickensian moment of silence.
A year later, he assumed the post as drama critic for the Dublin Mail. This would be Stoker getting into theater. And theater plays a huge role in Stoker's life and in his writings as well, too. And especially in Dracula. This is the same year that Lewis Carroll published Alice Through the Looking Glass. Charles Darwin published The Descent of Man. And J. Sheridan LeFanu published Carmilla. And what's interesting about J. Sheridan LeFanu, because I think Trevor and I have talked about like how much Carmilla influenced Stoker, and there's no direct evidence of that. But
it's hard not to look at
but here's the thing.
Both Carmilla and Dracula and see there's so much similarity there.
So here's the deal. LeFanu was part of Trinity College Dublin, right? He was a part of that. He also lived in a big mansion next door to the Wilde family of Oscar Wilde fame. Stoker and Wilde were contemporaries, and Stoker spent a lot of time with the family. And J. Sheridan LeFanu's works, not just Carmilla, but all of them, were really well known to that literary group in Trinity College. So even though there's no direct evidence that he like influenced it, there's a lot of evidence that he influenced it. Like, for example, I think Carmilla takes place with the vampire lives in like Syria or something. It's a female vampire. And Stoker, before he learns of the historical Dracula, his vampire, Count Wampir, I wish I were making that up, but I'm not.
It wouldn't be a W, though. It would be
it was W. Yeah.
Well, but he would still say it with a V, right?
Vampir.
Yeah, Vampir. Yeah, okay.
Vampir.
Yeah.
It would be Wampir.
Wampir.
This isn't Star Wars with wampas.
So the V,
thank God,
the V came in just because that's how people were always saying it.
But
right?
he originally set the story. Right. Yeah, Vampir. He originally set what would become Dracula in Syria until he read about and learned about Dracula, the historical figure, and he changed everything.
Right.
So yeah, there's plenty of evidence to say that he definitely was, you know, was knowledgeable of LeFanu and his works and Carmilla.
Yeah.
So just as he had done with the petty clerk sessions, right, Stoker revolutionized theater reviewing. Because like in the past, before Stoker comes along, they go see a play, they review it, they put it in the paper, and it doesn't come out for like 2 or 3 days later. But Stoker's like, no, this can be more efficient, just like the petty clerk office. So he revolutionized it to where once he wrote a review, it came out the next day.
There comes those petty clerk skills.
I'm telling you, man. I mean, he really...
We really should have used him for a lot of our fall movie reviews.
We should use him to write the scripts, because I think he'd be like, my God, you guys are just not efficient.
If you ever work a crummy medial job, just, you know, believe that those skills will pop up at just the right moment someday.
They will.
When it really matters, right?
This guy who's bottom 20% of his class...
Yeah.
And he, you know, proved he is incredibly efficient.
Boom.
Bam.
Well, I mean, think about everything that he does in one day. Like, mm-hmm. I would have to wake up at 3 a.m. and go to bed at midnight to do all the things that this guy did.
Yeah.
You know, to do trapezing.
Well, they didn't have TV. Rings. They didn't have phones. They didn't have radio.
I like the idea that he did all of these things in a single day.
Yeah. Yeah. This is all one day.
I'm doing my trapeze stuff.
Trapeze, rugby.
And then later on, I'm working at the clerk desk while I'm simultaneously...
reviewing this play that I just went to say.
And I'm reviewing stuff.
He sounds like a Superman kind of figure. Yeah. This guy's pretty cool.
He is pretty cool, and that's just the beginning of it. So in 1876, Stoker's dad died. Stoker's dad was still a big influence on him. I mean, if you remember the name of one of the main characters in Bram Stoker's Dracula, is Abraham Van Helsing. And it wasn't a, you know, I know Stoker's name was Abraham as well, too, but he really saw that character as a father figure. And it comes out that, you know, his father had a big impact on him. As I said earlier, though, he was in this point in time in the mid-70s, he was really kind of taking over his father's estate. He didn't have a lot to leave, like Stoker's mom or the rest of the family. And he had a lot of debt. So Stoker had to settle a lot of that debt and take over the estate, pay off some loans, pay off some bad affairs.
Shady individuals?
I think it just comes from him being just such a middle class character. Like, he wasn't like a wealthy individual, and so he's kind of stuck in this. You know, I see it almost as like the payday loans of today.
He's leveraged, and
he's leveraged. And we've got to pay it off. Mm-hmm. collect against like the different insurance policies and all of that. But this dynamic also allowed Stoker's politics to kind of come out, because his dad was very much a conservative Irish Catholic, and Stoker became very, very liberal-minded in that day and age. And you'll see that through some of the connections that he made. But one of the biggest connections that he made right as his father was dying was meeting the actor Henry Irving. And a lot of people don't really understand how the two met, or what they kind of how their meeting transpired. I know that he reviewed Henry Irving as Hamlet at one point, and Irving learned of the review, and the two of them ended up staying up late in a bar and just talking. And just from talking to Irving and capturing that hypnotic kind of, that very powerful presence that Irving had, that helped shape who the vampire would become in Bram Stoker's Dracula. But for most people, there was a lot of mystery into how they met. But a writer from the Leeds Times in July 13 of 1895 had a little insight into this. So this is what he wrote.
Not many know how Mr. Bram Stoker came to be associated with the fortunes of Sir Henry Irving. It was in this wise, says a contemporary. Sir Henry, when on a visit to Dublin, was invited to a supper party, and during the course of the evening was induced to recite in his thrilling way The Dream of Eugene Aram. One of his auditors, a young man with a brilliant reputation at Trinity College, was so affected by the tragedian's...
Wow, that's bad.
Tragedians?
Tragedians?
Tragedy, right? Tragedians?
Yeah, tragedians.
All right, let's try it again.
You can start just there. Was so affected by the tragedians... Oh, man, I don't know that word. Tragedians?
I never want to hear you make fun of my tangential...
Yeah, I've never seen this word!
Was so affected by the tragedian's delivery that he burst into tears. Henry Irving asked the young man to call on him the next morning, and then and there made him an offer, which he was accepted... made him an offer, which was accepted to the mutual advantage of both. The young man was Mr. Bram Stoker.
Very interesting. Thank you, original reporter from the Leeds Times from the 1890s,
Dad was born in Leeds.
Your dad was born in Leeds?
Yeah, that's where he's from.
Oh, that's cool. So that was an authentic accent then.
No.
Yeah, let's ask your dad.
Yeah, let's ask.
Hey, Dad, did I do okay, Dad?
Oh, heavens no. Bloody dreadful.
So as I said earlier, Stoker's of all of Stoker's novels and his short stories, Dracula was probably the most autobiographical. The role that Irving portrayed for Stoker and the relationship they had really affected heavily the vampire himself. What's really interesting about this is that he was also heavily influenced by a professor of English there at Trinity College, Edward Dowden, who introduced him to a radical new voice in poetry. And you want to talk about being liberal. I mean, I know Trevor and I had this discussion, mm-hmm. you know, a few days ago about what does liberal really mean in 1890s? Does it mean liberal as in today? And we thought maybe not. But then when you look at the fact that he met Walt Whitman, I think Walt Whitman would be considered liberal even by today's standards.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. I mean, Whitman was definitely a flavor.
Yeah. And they do eventually meet. I mean, Stoker at this point is just kind of learning about Walt Whitman and kind of realizing or studying some of his poetry, like Leaves of Grass and all of that. But and if you've ever seen like Dead Poets Society, like the O Captain, My Captain, that's all Walt Whitman.
I mean, we just saw a movie, 9 days.
9 days. This
concludes with monologue from Walt Whitman's poetry.
Yeah, from Leaves of Grass itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So Stoker was really, really, and especially as he's the son rallying against a conservative Catholic, he's really kind of, involving himself in this kind of politics and this kind of understanding. And it really becomes a case of hero worship, right, for Stoker. And he was also, at the time, to show this kind of influence on him and this kind of liberal kind of belief system. He's working in the theater. He's met Henry Irving. He's kind of introduced himself or kind of understanding now Walt Whitman. He's also really, really close to the Oscar Wilde's family, like his parents and his siblings. Well, Oscar Wilde is about 7 years younger than Stoker at this point. And in fact, Oscar Wilde.
Would you say that he was 7 years younger at other points?
I would.
No, just that point.
Well, it
just
depends. It depends. Actually, doesn't it depend? Like, if his birthday is before Stoker's, then there's a point in every year where he's like only 6 years younger.
You got me on a technicality, dude.
Technicality.
Yeah. I did.
But at that point, it was 7 years.
At that point, it was 7 years.
A worthy tangent.
I'm really interested in. This is really wild to me. Like, if you know anything about Oscar Wilde wrote The Importance of Being Earnest. He wrote The Picture of Dorian Gray. Oscar Wilde, his own sexuality is going to come to play in this story itself in a little bit. But it starts initially.
Showed his wild side, huh?
He showed his, yeah. He's going to walk on the wild side.
Wild thing.
With an E.
Well, Stoker went to spend Christmas 1 year with Wilde's family, and also there was this beautiful, beautiful young lady named Florence Balcombe. And whereas Stoker was athletic and strong and big and broad-shouldered, Oscar Wilde was a little more dainty. He liked to really dress nice. He was really kind of into fashion and clothing.
Sounds very Oscar Wilde-ish.
It does sound very Oscar Wilde-ish, doesn't it? Well, Oscar Wilde, like, really took a fancy to this girl, Florence, Balcombe. And they start dating, and they dated for, like, 2 years. And you know why they stopped dating? She told Wilde that she was marrying Bram Stoker.
Oh.
So they date for 2 years, and she ends it by telling him she's marrying this other guy.
Talk about a stake to the heart. Oh,
that's where the metaphor came from.
This is
all coming together.
Well, I mean, technically, the metaphor came from like them actually staking people in the heart because they thought they were vampires.
Oh, so what you're saying is that they would bury him
at crossroads. But yeah, this is a good tie-in to that.
It worked. He's dead.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure Oscar Wilde wanted to stake Bram Stoker through the heart.
Yeah, that is brutal. So not I have to break up with you because I like this other guy.
No. I'm marrying this other guy.
And he's like, which other guy?
The guy that was staying at your house when we met 2 years ago. He was staying with your family.
Like, to a certain extent, that kind of makes a little bit of sense because like there is kind of a courting ritual, but at this point in time, it was much more like, hey, you want to get married? And sure, yeah.
We're only going to live to 40. We need to make these decisions now.
Yeah. No, that's kind of it. And if you wanted any kind of mobility, it's like you just married the first guy who like asked you.
Really. I mean, technically, this is the second guy that comes along.
She's like, stability?
Yeah.
Let's go.
But he may have been the first one to ask.
He might have been the first one to ask. Yeah. And
Oscar Wilde is just,
damn it.
Prancing around the question.
Too much finesse on Oscar's part.
I think if the audience knows about Oscar Wilde, what we know about Oscar Wilde, prancing around the question might be pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Like,
there was like a dandy.
He was very much a dandy.
He sounds like a dandy.
He was very much a dandy.
Yeah.
But you know, Stoker's not without like without rumor and kind of question and as far as his sexuality too. Florence was very, very beautiful, but the rumor is she was also very, very frigid. And that is either due to Stoker's possible latent homosexuality or bisexuality. Oscar Wilde was he was a lot more public with it. Like the picture of Dorian Gray really dives into that kind of sexual discourse, whereas Stoker is a little bit more covered up, I guess, or kind of closeted, I suppose. I would say closeted. In any case, they only ever have one child. And that's amazing. I mean, this is amazing because she was supposed to be this great beauty. I mean, she came between these two guys. And she, you know, they only had this one child. And they blamed it on, like, it's almost like the biographers want to blame it on her frigidity. But they don't, you know, they want to, like, blame her for everything that happens with, like, this relationship. But that's really not fair, I don't think. I don't think we have the full story.
Comes back to the question of like who wrote this history, right?
Belford's like Barbara Belford. I mean, you would think she would have a feminine kind of take on this, but it really doesn't. Well, Stoker's done this, but it's because she was frigid. It's like, what if it's the other way around?
For the most part, I mean, I think a lot of what they're assuming about Stoker's life usually comes from something like a primary source. Like his journals or maybe his letters or something like that, right? Studying that information. But you kind of have to understand, like, that comes from Stoker's viewpoint, right? Not necessarily his wife's viewpoint. And maybe studying his wife's correspondence or studying his wife's journals, which we may not even have because who keeps that sort of thing, right? You know, that might shed a greater light on the issue. It could be maybe she was just not interested in a physical relationship and that quote unquote frigidity is legitimate, but maybe it's not, right? Maybe there's something
else.
There's also
this rumor that she just didn't want it. She had like this great body and she was like, I don't want to ruin it by having kids. And
that's fair.
I mean,
if I had a great bod, I wouldn't want to ruin it by making my wife have kids.
Oh my God.
That's disturbing on a lot of levels.
No, that was the joke.
So anyway, Stoker then starts building this professional relationship with Henry Irving. So they've met at this point. He marries Florence, Stoker does. He starts building this professional relationship. And he does so by editing this play by Irving called, it's all right, this is Dutch, so I'm going to butcher this. Van der Decken, which is a tale about Flying Dutchman, and it's the story about this like undead man. He's caught between life and death, and so even at this point, people are seeing like parallels between like what Stoker is like involving himself with and things he's working on, like plays and in theater, and what he's what's going to help shape Dracula at some point in the future. Stoker also was in love with London. Like fellow Irishman George Bernard Shaw, Irish writers saw, and Stoker saw, that the big thing to do to be a real literary talent was to move to London. Like, they couldn't just stay in Ireland.
But of course.
They had to move to London.
You go where the people are.
Yeah, it'd be like us today. Like, if I really cared about my writing, you know, I would move to New York. And I guess
I mean, there's a lot of that, right?
Yeah.
If you want to make it in the film industry, you go to L.A.
Yeah. So this is kind of the same idea back then.
Right.
So he picked up his wife and he moved. I mean, not literally, or maybe he did literally. I don't know. But he
certainly threw over his shoulder.
He was buff enough. Yeah. He picked her.
Yeah, with all of
his
trapezing, I'm sure he could rip anybody. That's right.
You think they fell in love because she was like, he's just such a marvel on the trapeze. And then he stopped trapezing, and she was like, I don't know. You don't do it for me anymore.
So he picked her up, and they moved to London. And he started, and this, I feel like this could have had like a huge impact on their relationship as well, too. But he started like letting his siblings stay with them. Like a couple of his brothers would come. Like a couple of them were even, like there were several of his siblings that got into the medical field. Like Thornley was a doctor and a surgeon, but also so were a couple of his other siblings. And they would come and like live with Stoker and his wife in their flat in London. And it's like, I'm sure that didn't probably help any kind of marriage issues that they were already suffering from.
I can't imagine how it would. Yeah.
But around this time,
just bring the in-laws around. That's always great for a relationship.
A good old dose of, yeah.
In 1878, around this time too, Henry Irving took over the Lyceum Theater in London, and he made Stoker his right-hand man. And what's cool about this is Henry Irving ran the Lyceum for 20 years, and Stoker worked for Henry Irving for like 25 years. I agree, puppy. That is such an
He's not going to get picked up by the mics, but his little grunts are hilarious.
His little grunts are hilarious right when I said that. I'm like, Stoker had a relationship with this guy, a professional relationship for 2.5 decades with this guy. And the dog goes, yeah. So a little bit about the Lyceum Theater. It was been an active theater since 1780s. It was rebuilt on a larger scale after a fire in 1830. Under Irving, it had a seating capacity of 2,000 and employed between 450 and 600 people.
It's pretty baller.
Wow.
That is amazing.
For a theater.
For a theater, that is huge. And it was successful. It was successful the entire time that Irving ran it. But Irving ran it with a fist of iron. I mean, he was just really hard-nosed on his people.
Fists of iron.
Fists of iron. Brought to you by Bram Stoker.
He probably hired Bram Stoker to... Because he was in the hist and the fist, so he knew.
It was all in the stars.
I need an iron fist. Well, that was what they called me in college.
Yeah.
Iron fist.
See, Toothless Joe, the guy that I used to play rugby against. That's not just a clever nickname. He really has no teeth. So Stoker was his right-hand man in all of this, and Stoker like carried out his policies and his rules and everything. He carried them out regularly and enthusiastically. Like, as hard as Henry Irving wanted to be on these characters, Stoker really supported that. For instance, in 1882, there was this already distinguished actor named Sir Frank Benson, and he was playing his first role with the Lyceum. And he was told he had to wear makeup for this role. But he thought, professional actor as he was, that wearing this makeup would kind of obscure his performance and the audience wouldn't necessarily get it. So he elected to have the makeup not put on. And his fellow actor, William Terrace, said, look, Stoker's going to catch you without your makeup on. They explicitly said they want you to wear makeup and you're not going to wear it. You're going to get in big trouble.
You're going to get the iron fist.
You're going to get the iron fist.
Yeah.
And
Stoker's just waiting there.
And Benson's like, pish posh, I don't care. I'll do what I want.
Pish posh.
Yeah. And that's spot on impression, by the way.
Thank you.
That's exactly what
I did a lot of YouTube videos watching Benson to get that accent down. Yeah. Stoker jumped his shit. Like, after they were done performing, like, Stoker, like, screamed at him and yelled at him and jumped his shit. And Stoker,
who do you think you are?
Who do you think you are? Oh, wait. No,
you come
bad.
In here and make this about you? There are 600
people
working here.
It's about me, damn it.
Right, yeah.
I am the Iron Fist.
You don't wear makeup, I'll show you makeup.
Told him he's going to be giving him a lesson in makeup. Stoker also had a major sway into kind of the plays they put on. Irving was very, very much into producing like Shakespearean plays, which were very popular at the time. But what would ultimately be Irving's downfall is the fact that he wouldn't want to modernize any of his plays. Like, he was sticking with Shakespeare when there were other people moving into like newer productions and newer production values. And that would eventually be the downfall of Irving. In 1879... he had the birth of his son, and the Irish, or at least the Stoker family, loved the name Noel, or loved the name Thornley.
Yeah, Noel.
So
is it Noel or Noel?
It's Noel. It's his son, so I'm assuming Noel.
But it's spelled like Noel.
Or Noel.
Splitting hairs,
I guess,
really.
It could be Noel.
Noel, I mean, either way.
Maybe it's just because we're just past the holiday season now, and it's...
have Noel
the
on the brain.
Noel. Yeah.
Should we tell Kate you have Noel on the brain?
Is
my bad. Like,
I mean,
who?
She may not take it so positively if she knew.
Hey, Kate.
Especially since it wasn't the first Noel.
No. So his name was Noel Noel Thornley?
Noel Thornley Stoker.
Okay, all right. I didn't know about the Noel part.
Yeah, he got beat up a lot too, I think. And this was also the first time.
Poor guy.
He was a Thornley in his dad's side. Oh, Jeremy.
Again, the same joke.
Did we tell it at the beginning of the episode, or did we cut it?
I don't know if we
have.
It's a real Schrodinger's joke right now.
We're going to have to cut down on these end points, dude.
it's either there or not. Only you, the listener, know. Yeah.
It's both funny and not.
I think our reaction to it might be funnier than the actual joke itself. Yeah. That's usually the case with my jokes, for those of you. If you're a long-time listener, you know this already. It's like
it's part of the pun. Like, it really doesn't work unless you have a good ground.
Speaking of which, every Monday on Twitter, we do Pun Monday. So if you're not a part of it, we'd welcome you to do hashtag Pun Monday.
No, seriously.
And give us your worst puns.
Pun Monday. It's so fun. It really is
the
very fun.
I know
there are a lot of you out on Twitter who love being in like writer community or whatever. Just use hashtag Pun Monday. Give us a bad pun.
Yep.
We love it.
Hashtag Pun Monday.
Yeah, make it a thing.
So in 1883, Stoker and Irving organized the first American North American tour of the Lyceum's Theater Company. This is where they met Walt Whitman for the first time in Philadelphia. Let's see. Do we want to have from Stoker's...
The personal experiences
of
Henry Irving.
So Stoker wrote the biography for Henry Irving. It's called The Personal Experiences of Henry Irving. And in this, he wrote about meeting Walt Whitman. And do we want to have somebody,
Curtis, why don't you give it a go?
Walt Whitman.
Yeah.
Commercial break two? Is that what
no,
this
no,
is?
No, no, no.
We're right before.
We're talking at this quote.
Sorry, I stopped reading.
What's the point of a script if you don't read it?
I got lost.
That's right. Our host's eyes are glazing over.
I'll go. I've got the part. Right. All right.
I found him all that I had ever dreamed of or wished for in him. Large-minded, broad-viewed, tolerant to the last degree, incarnate sympathy, understanding him with an insight that seemed more than human. A man amongst men.
And if you had any doubt about Stoker's sexuality, hopefully that cleared it up.
I don't know. I'm a little more confused than ever.
He was... Yeah. What a man he was.
I used to put on...
He was such a strapping man with big, broad shoulders.
Man.
A handsome, wonderfully large tongue.
I like the
mustache.
I like as he's describing this guy, there's still somebody in the audience who's like, I don't get it. I'm really not sure. I don't know. We are going to take just a brief break with another one of our amazing sponsors, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we'll be back in just a few minutes to continue the story of Bram Stoker.
This holiday season, show your family how much you appreciate them and give them Transylvania Steaks. When you give Transylvania Steaks, you give a unique experience they'll cherish always. For a limited time, send the perfect holiday gift at a very special price. Every Transylvania steak is aged in a kiln 21 days after carving to deliver the strongest wood fiber capable of penetrating the toughest vampire hearts. Every month, your loved one will receive a new steak in the mail, from ash to oak to maple to dogwood, custom hewn to fit all range of sizes, making Transylvania steaks perfect whether you're 9 or 90, male or female, an experienced vampire hunter, or a novice looking for a weekend activity, fun for the whole family. Transylvania Steaks. Get yours today.
Every day, hundreds of werewolves, rats, bats, and spiders are abused or killed. This season, thousands will die due to horrible cold, starvation, and neglect. Many of these animals are in pain, hurting from injuries caused by careless hunters and homeowners. Left untreated, these poor creatures will succumb to their injuries. Won't Won't you please help them? For $5 a month, you can provide fresh virginal meat for a lonely werewolf, or enough cheese and feces to reinvigorate the rat population and spread the bubonic plague in a community similar to your own, or enough flies to nourish a host of brown recluse spiders or rabies-carrying bats. Remember, if you're cold, they're cold. Please, won't you help today?
So I'm going to set the stage for you guys.
Do it.
It's 1888.
This is inappropriate.
What is that?
This is...
What did you say?
Are we in Colorado?
Let me set the stage. It's 1888.
It's 1888.
Australia.
Oh, there it is.
It's supposed to be...
You from Iowa?
Take us to
supposed to be a British accent.
Can you take us to Jamaica?
1888.
All right, I'll drop the accents then. It's 1888 in London. The Lyceum is putting on Macbeth, which has its own kind of weird occult kind of symbolism throughout the play.
Yeah,
we have the weird witches. We have, you know, the huge power struggle between Macbeth and King Duncan.
You don't even say that it is Macbeth if you're performing Macbeth, because you'll get like struck by stage lights and stuff.
I wore it in high school. I had a shirt that I found at Gadzooks. I just dated myself, and it had it said.
Before I met my wife, I dated myself all the time.
Yeah. it had a, like, a, you know, medieval-looking crest on it, kind of random, but it said Macbeth on it, and I went into the theater at my high school, and the theater teacher actually yelled at me.
Yeah.
For having that on.
Because there's a huge, like, Trevor.
And
you
I didn't
know
get
the...
it, so I thought she was just crazy. Well, she was, but...
Yeah, they usually are.
Yeah, it's a very superstitious thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if you mention or like show, like say Macbeth or anything in the theater, like tragedy is gonna happen.
Right.
She's like, are you wearing a Macbeth shirt in my theater? I think is how she reacted.
This podcast doesn't count as like a stage, right? Like we're not.
God, I hope not.
We're not just saying it so many times that like you know Candyman or something. He's gonna show up and
Macbeth is gonna appear and kill us.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I'm not remotely superstitious, so.
Okay.
On my end, you're good. You can say Macbeth all you want.
Awesome. Okay, great.
All right,
I just
awesome.
Need to make sure.
Yeah, no.
You know, because if the trees start moving, we're going to have a problem.
They might move a little. I hope that doesn't distract you too
much. Do you know what 1888 London is most famous for?
No.
Trevor, do you?
No.
Jack... the Ripper.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Now I do
Jack
know.
The Ripper was terrorizing
was the
South
time,
End.
Right?
Yes, yes. In London at this time as they were putting on Macbeth. And there was also the founding of something that I'm going to talk about in just a minute called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. So this is the occult.
That's so much cooler than
the Year of the Occult.
Order of the Phoenix.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so much cooler.
Oh, man, yeah.
Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn?
The Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. This is the,
like
the year of the occult in Stoker's life.
Sounds like the kind of cult I would join.
Yeah. Oh, wait till I get to it. I'm going to get to it here in just a second. Now, there's been a lot of debate on how influential the murders were on Stoker in writing his fiction, and especially in writing Dracula. There's not a lot of clarity, but again, it's one of those like Carmilla kind of things where it surely had to have
it's such a,
impacted
it's
him.
It's weird because I'm again, it's hard to contextualize from the moment, right? What it may have been like, because we put so much emphasis on it going back, like looking back in retrospect, the Jack the Ripper murders were kind of sensational. I feel like the historic record reflects that it was sensational enough that it's probably likely that this is on everybody's mind, right? I like, depending on which historian you talk to, the Jack the Ripper murders like were what ushered in right the age of media in the 20th century because it was
really
the sensationalization of what was going on.
Thanks, Jack.
You know, really, really kind of transformed public consciousness about these sorts of things.
His work was not pretty, but it served its role.
One of the loudest voices serving accolades to Stoker after Dracula was published was Sir Melville MacNaughton of Scotland Yard, who actually worked the Jack the Ripper murders. And he was fascinated with Stoker's detail about blood and how like the murders in the book were being carried out,
right?
Because it brought him back to that case and like having witnessed firsthand Jack the Ripper's kind of violence and his what he did to his victims.
Ooh. That's pretty brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess that's cool that a horror writer gets that kind of accolades. I mean, I don't feel like there's anything in the history books that he was like, "Hey, Stoker, where were you like when this shit was going on?" But, like. But that
I was trapezing. Sorry.
I have a very busy day.
Yeah.
I was writing volume those two of the Petticoat Junction. But yeah, so there's it's a pretty good consensus that the Ripper murders like influenced him. Like he was pretty well. I mean, everyone was aware. I think of they even were talking about it in the Americas. Like people knew like the Ripper murders were going on. In fact, they were talking about it in the Americas because a couple of years later, when Lizzie Borden had that famous case, like people tried to say Jack the Ripper had come to America and that was him like doing the killings there as well too. So this is like a worldwide, like you were right about that, Trevor. This is a worldwide like media attention grabbing kind of story.
The media especially like really latched on.
And it hasn't let up in like 150 years, 140 years, something like
seriously.
That.
We're still fascinated by it.
Like we're still talking about it. Like it's really interesting. But the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, this was the third part of the trifecta of the occult that kind of affected Stoker and Irving during this year. Now, we've all heard, at least in movies or watching these books, about like the occult secret societies. We've talked about like, you know, this kind of hidden message throughout the world, like this hidden knowledge that can only be released to certain people.
Yeah.
The Illuminati, all of this started.
The Freemasons.
Yes, the Freemasons. All of this started with the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. In fact, it was founded by one of the Freemasons, a coroner in London named William Wynne Westcott.
That's a name for the ages.
It is. Westcott wasn't the only founder. There were like two other people that helped him find the secret society. But Westcott was a Freemason, and he founded the order in 1888. They practiced ritual magic. Let's see, I've lost my place here.
Magic.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they practiced like seances. They did tarot. They did alchemy or tried to do alchemy. They did spells to like resuscitate like gods and like demons or speak to angels or speak to different spirits.
Oh,
I
mean,
they were really like into like the real black magic kind of stuff.
I'm scared of all those things.
I think it was just cool.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So you're out for the seance
really
after the recording?
I like Olivia Wilde.
Am I out of the seance? What?
I really hope that these guys.
Well, I don't think William Westcott looked
like Olivia Wilde.
I don't think William Westcott looked like Olivia Wilde.
Well, no, I would.
But
hope
this
not.
Would have been the
no,
same
I'm
thing
that
would
gods
have influenced.
They're trying to resurrect.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't know. I'm just, again, I like when it comes to cult things, I'm like, why would you want to do that? Unless they were Olivia Wilde.
But and that then, idea, sure, like the Gozer, the Gazarian, and the secret societies and stuff that they talk about in Ghostbusters, all that came from this. Rosicrucian, it was a Rosicrucian Freemason. And it's funny that I can say Rosicrucian when I can't say tangential. Hey, I just said tangential.
You did it. You're learning.
And I kept the S off, and I didn't sexualize the word. So, hey, I'm growing as a human being.
One of these days we'll move on from that.
The evolution of Jeremy Billingsley.
My co-host just asked me what Rosicrucian meant. thank you, guys. I'll define it for you.
Do this reading.
Yeah.
Like you're a second grader at a spelling bee.
Rosicrucian.
No.
I take it back. That'll take too long.
It will. All right. So basically what the thing behind Rosicrucian and kind of this belief system for the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, what they believe is that there is a secret knowledge passed down from the gods to different societies, to different like priests and different people who are deserving of this knowledge. And so they believe all of this was hidden into different grimoires, different texts throughout history. And so they don't think this information is viable for everybody, but they do believe that this is kind of like a knowledge that they need to carry on and press on. And it was very occult, very secret, you know, ritual magic, with the like magic spell, like not, I'm not talking like pull a rabbit out of the hat. I'm talking like M-A-G-I-C-K magic, like the scary, you know, casting spells and doing all this stuff. Yeah. This is what they believed in. And this wasn't just a bunch. I mean, it's, you might think it's a bunch of crackpots.
No, I'm looking at the guest list here of this Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and there's some names in here.
Like, Stoker was believed to be a part of this, but he wasn't the only one. Like, do you want to tell us some of the names that you're seeing?
Yeah, Aleister Crowley.
Aleister Crowley.
He wrote a bunch of weirdo, pseudo-religious texts.
I forgot what it was called.
Like, the Necronomicon, Thelema. Allegedly.
Thelema was his religion. He was kicked out of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn for being too wild.
Yeah. Too weird.
And he founded Thelema.
I mean, Crowley is the name that's given to virtually any demon, you know, associated
except
with
except we're mispronouncing it. Like, that's how
Crowley,
Black Sabbath pronounced Crowley? It. Was it Crowley?
Crowley.
Yeah.
Arthur Machen, another like very influential dark fantasy slash, you know, horror fiction writer. Mm-hmm. He would just be, just a writer. I don't know that genre exists in the same way in the 19th century.
I don't think it did. Yeah. I think they,
but definitely fluid. What would today be like a dark fantasy or a horror writer? Algernon Blackwood, same thing. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, that's the Sherlock Holmes guy.
William fucking Butler Yeats.
Yeah, William Butler Yeats.
is that the full title?
Fucking Butler Yeats. Where do you put the fucking in his name? Fucking William Butler Yeats?
If
William
you're mad fucking at him, that's what
Butler
you say.
Yeats? Only if you're
William
his
Butler
wife.
Fucking Yeats?
Yeah. It depends.
You only put fucking first if it's his wife. Fucking William Butler Yeats.
Oh, okay.
Oh, like it's,
I got you.
Like it's a verb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Authors, medical professionals, actors, poets, stockbrokers, scientists, political activists, college professors, musicians, bankers, filmmakers, playwrights, theologians.
School board members.
Your postal carrier. The guy who cuts meat at the grocery store. Yeah. I mean,
old Tony
Jack
down
the
on
Ripper.
The corner.
The Parent Teacher Association.
Yeah. Everyone.
Your youth
My lunch
pastor.
Lady.
The-
yeah, your youth pastor. Yeah.
Graham.
Everybody was in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. So yeah, so Stoker was accused or suspected of being involved in this as well. But what they're sure of one thing. Either he was involved in the Hermetic Order and so he knew about these things directly and he spoke about them in his novels and in Dracula, or he at least had friends who were involved with him. Now, you guys remember me talking about Oscar Wilde, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Oscar Wilde eventually got over Stoker stealing his woman and got married to a woman named Constance Lloyd Wilde, right? And they had a couple of kids together as well, too. But Constance Lloyd Wilde was also a member of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. When she got kind of tired or kind of like she was, I feel like when I read this about this, she was almost like trying to find something to fill her life because Oscar Wilde was going around filling his life with like guys and whatever else he could find. Like she
like
was trying
do.
To,
yeah.
She was trying to find a purpose, right? So I feel like the purpose, like she filled it first with the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. But when she got tired of that, she left for a little bit and joined Madame Blavatsky's troop. So Madame Blavatsky, if you want to talk about like as influential as the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn is on what we see as like this occult practices and magic and stuff, Madame Blavatsky was just as an inspirational kind of figure. She's the one that bought things like the Kabbalah. Did I mispronounce that? Is it Kabbalah?
The Kabbalah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Eastern religions, esoterica, and folded them into the spirituality of the Victorian age.
Mm.
And really kind of helped us formulate what the word occult means in like today's language. So Constance was jumping from like Madame Blavatsky to the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And she was informing Stoker, they believe, at least some of these guys were informing Stoker about some of these practices if he wasn't involved in them personally. And that spills over into Dracula and it's very, very heavy into the occult.
Esoterica?
Esoteric.
I've never heard of that. Now, is that something that a lot of people could understand or just a closed group?
No, I mean, unless you're really... Oh, I get it. It's a joke!
It's a joke.
I fell for it!
It's a joke.
I fell for it too.
Sorry. I knew that was going to be too nerdy and esoteric.
I'm really bad at reading like when someone's being earnest and like someone's just joking at me.
Yeah. I tend to give like super hard winks at people when I'm joking. Yeah.
But you make a good point because this was a very closed group. It was like the Freemason groups of today or like the right. what is it, the Elk Lodge or some of these groups that you have to join. The thing that was really modern about this, about the Hermetic Order, is that it did include women and men on the same level. It wasn't just a group of like a bunch of guys hanging
out.
It wasn't a boys club.
Right.
Definitely not a boys club. But it was very, very closed door. Like they didn't want any of their stuff getting out to anybody. So in 1890, well, what's important too about the reason I also mentioned Madame Blavatsky is that later her beliefs in like, in some of this Aryan belief system would later like influence the Nazis. And if those of you out there who aren't, clear about this, the Nazis were very, very heavy into the occult and they were very influenced by the occult.
I didn't know that. No.
They were, yeah.
Oh,
they were,
no. Yeah. Hitler collected a whole bunch of like relics and stuff like that.
That stuff from Indiana Jones about him looking for occult
that's
relics.
That's a basis in reality.
Yeah, that
I
was
mean,
real.
The they, events of Indiana Jones, of
were
course,
they trying
totally
to
fictional.
Control the outcome of the war with,
they
like,
were.
With spells?
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. I don't. Maybe.
You know,
well,
I
Hitler
mean,
was
anything,
at least. Hitler
like
was.
Hitler was also on just like a fuck ton of drugs too.
Yeah.
Like, well, and he really ordered can't. Like the Nazis to be put on a fuck ton of drugs too, to like make some of those marches. Yeah. Like when they went to invade Russia, he like had them all on like basically the modern day equivalent of meth.
And to a certain
they were like
extent,
berserkers to the Vikings. Right?
And I'm just gonna go off on a limb here and just kind of guess, but I mean, to a certain extent, you kind of maybe want to control some of the religious or kind of occultish ideas. You know, that you're kind of setting up in your governance, because occultism, I think religion, is a powerful force in controlling people. Right. And so you, if you can control that narrative or you can set that narrative, you can manipulate a whole lot of people.
And you see this very thing mirrored in like cults today. Like
absolutely.
This knowledge is secret. You haven't earned the right to learn this knowledge yet. So we're going to keep it from you.
Isn't that's all Scientology.
Scientology.
Right? Scientology is all about that.
Well, you got to pay $250 if you want to know the secret.
Right.
Yeah. So, you can't get to Tom Cruise level without, a couple million bucks.
Imagine what that guy knows. Sometimes I do wish we were on video because I think the face I made was better than just that. So around 1890, Stoker publishes his first novel. Now, he's already published that manual, but he's published his first novel called The Snake's Pass. He also begins research on... He also begins...
We're not
I've lost
there,
Curtis.
Right?
Curtis is gone. Curtis is... He's just rolling on the floor.
My eyes are in the back of my head.
He's also begun research on the novel The Undead, which would later become Dracula. Now, this is 1890, so it's about 6 years before... 6 or 7 years before the novel actually reaches publication. He doesn't do this level of research with all of his books. That shows kind of how important Dracula was to him, even at this point. Like, he understood what he was trying to say with this novel, and that it would almost be like the pinnacle of his literary career. I think he had that kind of understanding with it. I mean, Trevor's kind of, is he making a face? Is he going to disagree? Or, I mean, if you do, it's okay. Now, I have in our script listed probably, about 15 different sources.
That's why I was frowning. I was looking at all these sources.
I'm not naming all of these. What I'm going to do, though, I think what would be good is, as I'm listing our sources for that inspired us to write the script, I think I'm going to list the sources that influenced Stoker's Dracula on our webpage, too. So if you want to see all the things that influenced him, the one I will talk about is a book by William Wilkinson. All these British guys had like WW names. Like
I keep telling my wife that if we ever have a kid, I want to name him Will William Williamson. Because I think that's hilarious.
Well, alliteration is very
Bill?
Important sometimes.
Yeah. Well, it's all just the same name.
William
just
Wordsworth?
Longer and longer.
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. So the reason William Wilkinson is important is because he was the source for the historical Dracula. But Stoker pulled on a lot of different sources or pulled from a lot of different sources to address, rituals and customs in that part of the world. He looked at, sources on mythology. He looked at a lot of things to really influence him. Now, the last thing that I want to discuss before our next, our final commercial break for the episode or episodes. I mean, this could be long enough. We could break this thing up, right? I mean, is that in 1895, he published two novels, even as Henry Irving and his brother Thornley are knighted by Queen Victoria. This is also during the time that Oscar Wilde went on trial for his indecencies.
Oh, Oscar.
Oscar, you indecent
devil. You dandy.
Devil.
You indecent dandy.
So on May 25th, Queen Victoria knighted Stoker's mentor and friend and his brother. She normally stuck to, she was famous for sticking to the traditional words of the knighting ceremony, but as she laid the sword on Irving's shoulder, she added, "I am very, very pleased," which just goes to show how influential Irving was even on the queen and on the court, how important he was seen.
Special guy.
Meanwhile, this is Oscar Wilde's second trial of, it's not just indecency. It's gross indecency.
Well, I mean, that's means,
where, that's where it makes you go gross.
Pretty specific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they were.
Do you have any more details or?
Well,
gross indecency?
I mean,
I don't know the legal definition of gross indecency.
He was caught.
Just, gross meaning like in volume, not necessarily in.
Well, knowing the prudishness of some of these Victorians, it probably was gross. Ew. You stuck your penis well.
You told me you were going to do what?
I've heard of brown nosing, but this is ridiculous.
Yikes.
Gross.
So if you haven't gleaned what we're talking about when we talk about he was put on trial... I'm sorry, you're just a lost cause. He was put on trial for homosexual activities.
Yep.
And he was convicted and put to prison for these practices. He was also wildly popular at this time. He had just published the book Picture of Dorian Gray, which has its own parallels, like Faustian parallels with Dracula. And he had his play, The Importance of Being Earnest, was out. He was well known to dabble in like bisexuality. Like he was married to Constance Lloyd Wilde, but he was also like engaging with different men. And these were themes that he was, you know, like Dorian Gray, like explores these themes of bisexuality in the book. Mm-hmm. And he was definitely going on in this.
Do you think he would have gotten in so much trouble and smeared and all that if he weren't a famous person? You think maybe, you know, it's like Willie at the airport.
It's hard.
Getting busted for weed.
Maybe it's hard to know.
Possibly.
I don't know the answer.
It would have been
that.
Definitely scandalous back then.
Right.
Like this would have definitely.
Any old person or is it
you
like,
raise a good question.
Make an example out of this guy.
You raise a good question. It could be just making an example of him.
Right.
Right. Like he's because he's pretty well known.
Yeah.
In a lot of these circles, you know, like hitting Oscar Wilde could send the message that, you know.
Yeah, it's very really plausible, right? Yeah.
And that's
if
something you guys
else,
can.
It's plausible.
Yeah, and that's something definitely that people can think about. I mean, think about this: people were not just imprisoned for homosexuality, but they were also like thrown in you know asylums, like mental asylums.
Right, right.
So, so this was something that was very. I mean,
or worse.
It, right.
Or worse.
Yeah. Or worse. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. They're put in Hellraiser 2.
Yeah.
Throwback.
Or Hellraiser 3 through 10.
Right,
like,
yeah.
It's like, yeah, I couldn't even make it into Hellraiser 2.
Yeah. Gross indecency. I sentence you to Hellraiser 5.